it's my pleasure to introduce Chad Marriott, who's going to lead this panel and moderate it, because he exemplifies that kind of person that can pull together people and groups. He's in the energy practice at Stoll Reeves, and he's done just about everything you can imagine, from the financing, the regulation, contractual financing areas and partnerships. Does an outstanding job, and one of the things that he gives back also to our clean tech community is he serves on a national number of different boards, and one of those is near and dear to my heart, and that's the Ocean Renewable Energy Coalition. That's been a great support of our title project. So without further ado, I'd like to have you help me welcome Chad Marriott. Chad.
Unenviable task of standing at the podium after Secretary Gates and after lunch, which means people are tired and intellectually full. But I think what we're going to do is keep this panel very interesting, a fantastic panel today. To start things off, and maybe to frame the conversation a little bit, the Department of Defense is by far the largest U.S. government user of energy. Operational energy and installation energy, we heard a little bit about that before from Secretary Burke. Operational energy is the energy required for training, moving, sustaining military forces and weapons platforms. Installation energy generally refers to hardened bases. So typically when you think of installation energy, you're thinking of non-tactical vehicles, you're thinking of electricity usage. According to a Congressional Research Service report that was published in December, about 75% of DoD's energy use is operational energy, and about 25% is installation energy. However, Congress has yet to set any specific energy reduction targets for operational energy. We're fortunate to hear from Assistant Secretary Burke earlier, who is working daily to address the operational energy needs and challenges that are facing the DoD today. Approximately two-thirds of DoD energy consumption, and this is across both operational and installation energy uses, is linked to petroleum-based liquid fuels. In FY 2011, the DoD's fuel costs reached $17 billion. That's for FY 2011 alone. The CRS highlighted that the DoD's reliance on fuel has led to financial, operational, and strategic challenges for the Department of Defense. Financial risk is one that many of you know very well. It has both long and short-term components. We're talking about the long-term risk of continued rising fuel prices and the short-term risk of fuel price volatility. Operational risks involve moving fuel to the battlefield, the impacts on force mobility and combat effectiveness, and the vulnerability of supply lines. Secretary Burke covered those pretty well. Strategic challenges include the establishment and security of supply lines in various parts of the world where U.S. soldiers, sailors, and Marines operate, and ensuring the global free flow of fuel and oil, which is something that Secretary Gates spoke to. Back in 2012, the DoD requested about $1.5 billion for operational energy initiatives in this fiscal year 2013. On January 2nd, President Obama signed the 2013 National Defense Authorization Act, which included Senator Mark Udall's amendment, which came in kind of under the wire for those of us that were paying attention, which retained DoD's authority to procure alternative fuels. And that, it's worth noting, was an amendment that was supported both by Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus. I'd like to thank our panelists for being here today for this conversation. The framework for the conversation is really as President Obama begins his second term, energy use and the effects of climate change are going to drive an important part of the national security debate. Making quick introductions, I'm just going to do some introductions and then I'm going to give the four of them the floor for probably 20 minutes or so to make some statements, talk about what they want to talk about. And then for the remainder of the time, I have some questions, and I'm sure you have many questions yourselves. So I want to leave plenty of time for you to ask our experts and get the answers that you came here looking for today. First, we have Congressman Adam Smith, second seat over. On the end, Major General Jeff Buchanan, who's the Deputy Commanding General of Joint Base Enlisted Corps here in Washington. In front of me, retired Brigadier General Stephen Cheney, who is currently the CEO of the American Security Project. And then third down, Andrew Holland, who is the Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at the American Security Project. So starting with the Congressman, if you'd like to make some statements, we'll just kind of roll in after that. And General, if you'd like to start as soon as the Congressman is finished, that'd be great.
Okay, sure, thanks.
Trevor, thank you very much. It is, it seems like, I'm sure Secretary Gates covered a wide variety of ground that we're looking at here, and will not attempt to be duplicative. But I think this is an incredibly important conversation, and when we look at the policies that we're going to adopt within the National Defense Authorizing Act each year and how it impacts this broader conversation, learning more about how best to do that is critical. There's two broad policy areas within the Department of Defense. One, energy unquestionably is a critical part of any fighting force, and you can walk through the history of warfare and see where access to energy in a timely manner is often decisive. So making sure that we have the energy sources that we need operationally in terms of installations, you know, domestically for training, and then overseas, wherever we're operating, is critically important. So that is one piece of it. The second piece of it, I think, is just as important, and that is the broader issue that was just raised, and that's climate change, and that's the impact of burning fossil fuels and the negative impact that they have on our environment. And that's one of the debates that we get into frequently on the Armed Services Committee between the House and the Senate, is that we should be laser-like focused, you know, whatever the cheapest energy is the DOD can buy, whatever they can get right now, that should be the focus. We shouldn't be worried about those broader issues, and I disagree with that. Those broader issues also fit into our national security needs and concerns, and if we are destroying the environment with the fuel that we're burning, then we're not really doing ourselves any favors in the short or the long term. So both are legitimate questions as we look at what we should put together for our national security policy. The Department of Defense is going to be a critical piece of this. As was mentioned, that the largest consumer of energy in the United States and the decisions they make can drive innovation and can drive decisions. That's why the battle that we have had year in and year out on the Armed Services Committee is to make sure that we protect the Department of Defense's ability to innovate, their ability to employ alternative fuels, and try to generate as much efficiency as possible. And we're going to keep fighting them. Senator Udall's amendment was actually to, you know, strip an amendment that had been put in committee that would have severely restricted the ability of the Department of Defense to buy alternative fuels. We need to protect that. I think the DOD should be out there aggressively pushing the market and being a major consumer that moves us towards greater alternatives, greater efficiencies, and improved technology. And that's one of the biggest things that I worked on. We have a ton of companies here in the Pacific Northwest, but there are some elsewhere. We don't have a complete monopoly on it, even though we'd like to think we do. We certainly have a lot of really good innovation in the energy sector. I know a lot of those companies are reflected here. We want to make sure the DOD is aware of those folks so that they can buy those technologies, buy those alternative sources of fuel, both to help the Department of Defense obviously get access to the best possible technology, but also to encourage the growth of those technologies to get to scale. It's one of the fundamental challenges we face is the fossil fuel industry has about a 150-year head start in terms of infrastructure. And, you know, people, one of the arguments that's frequently made in the fossil fuel arena is, you know, well, it's unfair to have, you know, public sector subsidizing, you know, competitors. It's like we, you know, that we've already pocketed our money on that, but still pocketed more, as a matter of fact. But even, you know, you go back the 150 years and everything the government did to, you know, help the fossil fuel industry get to where it was at, I think it's remarkably short-sighted to now say that we shouldn't do the same for new alternative fuels that are clearly in our best interest. So, you know, we have to balance that, obviously. You want to encourage the private sector to take the lead as much as possible. I don't think that the government should be in the business of picking winners and losers. You know, we should figure out what our policy objective is and say we want, you know, the most, you know, clean burning, renewable, affordable, whatever it is, the goals are, set those and then let the technology come to you. But I do think we have a role to get us to the point where we are not as dependent on fossil fuels for a wide variety of reasons. You know, the price of oil spikes up and down, you know, this is going to be an ironic comment, which will be clear in a moment. One of the problems with DOD is they don't know. Year in and year out, they guess what the price of oil is going to be, and then at the end of the year, they wind up frequently with a bill that's substantially larger than what they expected. It's a problem when you don't know exactly how much money you're going to have to spend. It's ironic because of sequestration and the fact that we've been on much more than energy jerking around the Pentagon here in recent months, as well as the entire government, about not knowing exactly how much money they're going to have from month to month, but it's not a good thing. Even if we're doing it far more than we should be, it's not a good thing. Some degree of certainty, options, alternatives, some place to go other than having a complete dependency on oil would be in the best interest of our national security comprehensively. And we have to work to achieve that goal. And in some cases, you know, short term, it may be a little bit more expensive to go with an alternative, but if long term that gives us more options, a more dependable source of energy, and a cleaner planet, then those are decisions we need to make. I look forward to your questions and the comments of the other panelists, and just want to offer for everyone here whatever my office can do to help. As the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, I'm in a position to make a lot of these decisions in terms of what goes into the NDAA and influence them. And I want to do my best in those issues along the lines that I just laid out. So please think of me and my office as a resource on these issues. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. I appreciate your comments. And I want to thank you for inviting us at Joint Base Lewis-McChord to participate today. It's an opportunity to share a little bit about what's going on in the Army and what's going on a little bit smaller scale on my perspective on the Air Force side. But more importantly, it's an opportunity for us to learn. I'll limit my comments mostly to the Army or the joint experience I've had while deployed, because that's where most of my experience is, and I don't want to presume too much to talk for the Navy or the Air Force. But I will say that the Army, for many, many years, has taken for granted our access to energy sources that are abundant and affordable. And the bottom line is, we can't afford to do that anymore. We depend on fossil fuels, as Congressman Smith just talked about, to both power our installations and to provide energy for all of our operations, wherever they may be. I sort of look at it as a crutch. And the problem is, the crutch is not necessarily on stable ground. And I don't want to plow territory that's already been covered by either Secretary Burke or former Secretary Gates when they talk about the environment and how complex it is and uncertain the environment is. But suffice it to say, we depend a lot on energy. We're the world's largest consumer of petroleum products. And here's a statistic for you that you might find surprising. Today, we have 20 fewer soldiers than we had in World War II, but every one of those uses on average 20 times as much energy as our soldiers did in World War II. So energy is both a force multiplier. We need it for our operations, but it's also a point of vulnerability. And for all of those reasons, we have to change how we use energy. And it seems, from my perspective at least, that one of the key things is that we have to change our culture. Our culture within the services, and in particular in the Army. I'm going to give you a couple of snapshots here, because we've talked about convoys, but you'd be shocked at how much of our operations, in fact, depend on energy sources, and how much of those are driven by convoys. Although Secretary Burke, I thought, did a great job by showing the helicopter bringing fuel to a combat outpost. In my last tour in Iraq, which is in the last half of 2010 and all of 2011, we were, at that time, you may remember, we had gone from a height of 170,000 troops in Iraq down to about 50,000, which we had for the majority of the last 18 months that we were there. And on any given week during that time frame, we had about 500 convoys on the road. Sometimes 13,000, sometimes 15,000 trucks when you add up all the number of trucks. About 80% of those convoys was dedicated to sustainment, which is primarily fuel and water. Every one of those convoys, of course, has to be escorted by troops, many of them driven by third world nationals, we call them, but contractors driving the trucks. But we have our troops conducting the reconnaissance, providing security en route, and every one of them is subject to attack. And if you think back, the majority of the IED attacks in Iraq came on convoys rather than dismounted troops, and the IEDs were the greatest killer of our troops on the battlefield. We still have IEDs, significant problem with IEDs in Afghanistan, but the latest trend is that many more of them are attacking our troops on dismounted patrols rather than in convoys. Now, the fuel was not just used to fuel trucks and helicopters and generators. We actually used fuels and to fuel, we used fuels to power incinerators, which was one of the fixes to the burn pit problems that were brought up back here. Clean incinerators. Okay, now, the largest base complex in Iraq was a place called Camp Victory, and I know that some of you have been there in the past. At one point in time, we had 65,000 troops and contractors living on this one base complex. 8 incinerators to handle all the garbage that was generated every day in Camp Victory. And in order to fuel those incinerators, they burned 12,000 gallons of JP-8, which is a military-grade diesel fuel, every single day to handle that trash. Pretty phenomenal amount, $25,000 a day to burn trash. I mean, the good news is it wasn't getting burned in burn pits, but still a lot of fuel going up in the air. Now, at the soldier level, I've been an infantry officer now for more than 30 years, so I've spent my time in jungles and deserts carrying rucksacks. And so I tend to think of how does the individual soldier look at what's going on. About 11 years ago, I was stationed at the infantry school for 10 months, and actually most of that time I was deployed to Iraq, but I was stationed there. And I remember one study that an infantry squad, this is 11 people, an infantry squad in 2003 had to carry 28 different types of batteries. Okay, now that's not just the number of batteries, 28 different types to power all of the different devices they had. And that's because we as a bureaucracy looked at the soldier as kind of the end product rather than the start point. And we've fundamentally changed how we look at this. We look at the soldier as a system, and rather than just hanging more night vision devices and communication gear on the soldier, we look at what does the soldier need and what sort of efficiencies can we use when we develop power sources. So we have made some changes. I mean, the good news is we have made some changes, and just sticking within fossil fuels, we've worked on and developed a 3% increase in efficiency in our tactical vehicles, our tanks, and our Bradley fighting vehicles, and how they use fuel. Significant movement ahead in developing more efficient aircraft engines for our helicopters, and a better and more innovative use of all our simulators, so we actually don't have to fly as much just to get some of the training value. And for those of you that aren't pilots, there are some things that you have to train on in a simulator because you can't replicate that in an aircraft or you're going to crash it. So training on simulators is very, very important. We've also reduced fuel consumption in our non-tactical fleet. So this gets at the facility side of the base a little bit, and then we've reduced the size of our non-tactical fleets, gone more to hybrid vehicles, use of electric cars, et cetera, and so reduce the size and made them more efficient. And on the garbage, there's a new technology. Now, I haven't seen the acronym, but I'm guessing there is one. It's called Tactical Garbage to Energy Refinery, and I think the acronym is TIGER. Okay, so I don't want to bring Winnie the Pooh to mind, but this actually combines two different technologies, advanced fermentation and thermal decomposition, to turn trash into fuel. And for example, turns about 2,000 pounds of garbage into fuel to run a 60K generator. Now, that's the opposite of drawing on fuel to burn garbage. So again, innovation is critical, and it's headed us in the right direction. And the last comment is that we are looking at the soldier as a starting point, and the soldier is a system now. We're now down to 4 or 7, ma'am, different battery types, but it's way down from 28. And just as importantly, we've reduced the weight by about 30% that an average squad carries in power sources, and increasingly rely on deployable solar panels to recharge batteries and things like this. So as a guy who's had to carry those rucksacks, I definitely appreciate it. The bottom line is we've accomplished a lot, but we have a heck of a long ways to go. I think the most important thing that we can do is change our culture so that every soldier is a power manager. It starts at the individual level, but if every one of us looks at this as an important operational problem, and we start from the thought, or from the beginning thought, that power and energy considerations have to be a part of every operation, we're actually going to go much farther towards winning the fight. Smart energy is going to win the fight, but we can't afford to operate the way we have in the past.
General, great comments. Thank you for your service. I was an artillery officer for 31 years. The difference between artillery and infantry is we lend dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl. But I've been retired for a dozen years and a little bit away from the fray, but we're from Washington, D.C., myself and Andrew, and those who watched the inauguration the other day saw a very unusual event in that Beyonce is perhaps the only one in Washington whose lips move and nothing comes out. But we're happy to be here on the West Coast. Now, I haven't spent much time in Seattle, and my wife said this is a golden opportunity, and we can come and play the tourist thing, go up the Space Needle, which we did yesterday. And we went up and looked down, and she turns to me and says, lo and behold, there's two buildings with solar panels on top. And I said, there's the example of an eternal optimist, solar panels in Seattle. And this has got to be my kind of place, so we're really enjoyed to be here. Let me give you a little background about the American Security Project, which I'm sure not many of you know much about. And I'm sure Chad and the Clean Technology Alliance did not plan this, but this has been a core issue for us since our inception in 2006. In 2005, two senators, Hagel and Kerry, got together and said, isn't it terrible that a number of the issues that we bring up in any forum, we get slayed either by the far right or the far left, not the least of which was climate change and energy security. So they enlisted the help of Senators Rudman and Hart, along with various others, and said, let's put together a board that's comprised of an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. Let's throw in a couple of prominent business folks like Norm Augustine from Lockheed Martin, and then get a number of admirals and generals, preferably in 3- and 4-star rank from each of the services, and discuss all these issues from a national security perspective, which is the focus of today's event, talking about clean energy and national security. So we did that in 2006 and incorporated in Washington, D.C., and that's how I became involved. You can imagine today, when you look back on this issue back then, Senator Kerry, of course, was coming off a bruising campaign. Anytime you talk climate change, you get painted as a left-wing liberal. Hagel had an interest, a very deep interest in it, a little bit fearful to bring it up because he would get painted by the Tea Party as being the same. So we commenced upon a number of studies and a number of papers that we have published in the last several years, not the least of which is one that Andrew put out in November on called a climate security report. And I mentioned it to you today because now, of course, it's become extremely timely given what's going to happen to Secretary Kerry. The committee will vote tomorrow, and I would presume the floor will vote on Wednesday. He'll be the next Secretary of State. Secretary Hagel, a little bit more problematic, of course, if you follow the press. But we've been a bit inundated, as they've been our founding fathers, by some of the press saying, where do they stand on these issues? And I just harken back to the papers we put out, and you can read them, and you can see where they stand, and they put their names to them. And I mention it today because, to me, trying to be nonpartisan on the issue, we've got a real target of opportunity here. It's already stated you're going to have, I think, a Secretary of Defense that is inclined this way. And of course, Senator Kerry, soon to be Secretary of State, climate change is one of his biggest issues. A little more difficult from the Secretary of State perch, but these are going to be two big supporters. And of course, President Obama mentioned it in the inauguration. So Sharon, I think your job's safe for the next 4 years. And listening to the speakers today, it's kind of put my presence in a great perspective, because Sharon, you talked about DOD and how it's used and what's going on and a little bit more tactical level. Of course, Secretary Gates, way up on the strategic level, when I asked him the question about funding, it was a great answer, of course. You need to look at the strategy, you need to look at the requirements, and then when you look at that, you can determine how much you need and how much you're going to spend. On the issue of climate change and energy, we are so vulnerable because of fossil fuels, and it's been pointed out certainly by the General, by Sharon, by the Secretary. But I'll just give you another statistic to pony up on those. From 2005 to 2011, DOD's fuel consumption use actually went down 4%. You ready what the price increase was? 385%. 385%. Just another proof to the point that even though we are now producing more oil and more gas, we're paying a lot more for it. And as Secretary Gates pointed out, it's not our market, it's a global market. Just last week, I was in a forum with Senator Coates from Indiana and asked him a very similar question about energy. And his answer, which was on the record at the Council on Foreign Relations, you can Google it and look it up, was we don't have to worry about it anymore. We're going to be energy independent. We're drilling more oil. We've got enough natural gas for 100 years. Basically saying it's not a problem. That's where the American Security Project comes in, because we've got to educate people on this is a huge problem. Now, one thing, in my opinion, that fracking has done with the natural gas and oil, it's given us a little bit more breathing space here in times to go after these technologies, clean technologies, and hopefully convince Capitol Hill and the public that this is indeed a problem that we really, really have to study. Sharon, you didn't go into depth on Secretary Mabus, which you mentioned him, but RIMPAC and the whole exercise they held in Hawaii this past summer, where they used biofuels to drive the fleet as well as the aircraft. Biofuels are here, but the technology is here today. We still have to make more investment in it. There are more improvements to go. Yes, it's expensive, but if I read it right, I think they're predicting by 2017 or 18, the price of a gallon of biofuel will be equal to the price of a fossil-derived fuel. So, I mean, there's tremendous advantages on the biofuel side of the house, not the least of which I like to say it's made in America. We can grow it here. Now I know, Andrew, I'm stealing a little bit of your thunder talking about biofuel, but you can tell from the American Security Project's perspective, we're huge proponents of biofuels and alternative energies. And of course, we're big on the climate change, climate side of the house as well. And this has been another watershed year. Not to say Sandy was a good thing, it was a terrible thing on the East Coast. But when you combine that with all the other natural disasters we've had over the past couple of years, and I spent 5 years in deep South Texas prior to coming to ASP. When I first got there, they had great cotton crops, great cattle. They have none of that anymore, none. Everything is dry, the cattle are gone. And to top it off, I ran a school there for 5 years. We had a hurricane that just decimated the campus. If you don't think climate change is happening, then you must be blind. So, and there's a direct correlation, in my opinion, between how man's contributing to climate change and pollution, and we need to tackle those issues. So, let me close on one last point here, and Sharon, again, I'm leaning on your presentation this morning, but I love the slide you put up with General Allen and General Mattis, of course, two of my very good friends, and two Marines, I might point out. General Mattis is a gold mine, and he is a Washington State product. A graduate of Central Washington, he comes from Pullman, Washington, and he retires next month. He is not being shoved out early, as some of the press says. That was his standard rotation and time to retire date. And he said he's coming back here. So I just encourage you all to get your grips on him and put him on your board. And with him and Secretary Gates, you're in pretty good form. With that, I'll turn it over to Andrew.
Thanks, Steve. And I guess my duty here is to say my piece and get out of the way as much as possible so we can get to questions and talk more with this great panel. But what I'm going to talk about is get a little bit more specific. ASP has a report coming out tomorrow, Advanced Biofuels and National Security. I have one other copy for the first person who can get to me if they want it. But otherwise, a quick plug. to go on to AmericanSecurityProject.org. It'll be live at midnight tonight. And basically, you know, the question that we get asked a lot is why do we need alternative fuels? Why do we need biofuels? And basically, as Steve said about the senator talking about these issues, we've suddenly got all of this stuff. We've got all this oil. We don't have to worry about that. But the truth is that America does need an alternative to oil. You know, we will still continue to use oil for a long time, but we shouldn't be dependent upon oil. That dependency undermines our leverage in foreign affairs, as Secretary Gates really ably pointed out. It contributes to climate change. And, you know, one other thing that I'd add that Sharon mentioned a little bit, but to go into more detail on, it's dangerous to be dependent on just one fuel that will ultimately run out. You know, someday it'll run out. It is a non-renewable fuel. Now, whether that'll be in 2050 or 2100 or whenever, at some point, there's a declining amount out there. And when you think about the military, this is especially salient because, you know, you look at the B-52s flying right now were made in the 1950s and 1960s. That's an airframe that dates from 1952. Today, we're buying the F-35, the beginning of the largest acquisition program in DoD history, estimated to cost $1.5 trillion over its lifetime, depending on how you do inflation, but $1.5 trillion over its lifetime. And that lifetime is expected to be out to 2050 or 2060. So that those planes will still be flying and still need to be flying on an energy-dense liquid fuel. Now, can you tell me in 2060, will the United States still be producing almost 1 million barrels a day of oil from the Bakken in North Dakota? Will these fields still be producing? Simply put, we don't know. Maybe we'll find more. Maybe we'll find more in the outer continental shelf. But between 2060 and 2013 now, is a long, long time. Think back to the difference in, you know, how much oil production was coming in the early 1950s, 1960s, when the B-52 was first being put into service. So the Pentagon has this unique ability in Washington to be able to think a bit more long-term. I know Secretary Gates said that Washington long-term is next week, but the Pentagon, at least, beyond other departments in Washington, can think long term and has to think long term because of these long term programs. So, you know, I'd say that having an energy dense liquid fuel and that is an alternative to oil is extremely important. Now, just to say, you know, a few things about advanced biofuels. This is no longer a unicorn. This is no longer something that doesn't exist, but we really want it to. These are being produced in America now from a variety of feedstocks, from a variety of technologies. And as Congressman Smith said, this is about setting standards and then letting the market decide. And you know, there's a huge amount of opportunity in this area right now, and I think a lot of the people here in this room are doing some work to get it going, and I'd encourage you all to download our report and look forward to your questions.
Congressman Smith, I want to follow up. Stephen, I love the fact that you brought up that statistic because in my questions, the idea that between 2005 and 2011 we had a 4% decrease in fuel use by the Department of Defense, and yet the amount that we spent jumped to $17.3 billion in 2011. It's a 380%+ increase. There's been a lot of discussion, and it was brought up in a question earlier, Congressman, about the potential for long-term contracting for alternative fuels. Now, when we look back and, you know, we wish we were in this position in 2005 saying, I would love to lock in a contract, a 10-year contract for the price of fuel today, knowing that there would be a 381% increase. The problem is that we don't know, but I think the question is still begged, knowing that it has and it has continued to increase. What is the status of that conversation for long-term contracting for fuel procurement by DLA?
Well, we haven't been able to get it yet, but it's, I think, one of the foremost policy objectives that we should have in advancing the interests that have been described here, to give the ability to do long-term contracts for alternative fuels. Now, you're right, I mean, there's risk involved in that. I mean, people got whiplash terribly in the oil markets. You know, we did long-term contracts, and, you know, if you did, some people did long-term contracts at the partner at the maximum price and they came down. I think in biofuels it's relatively safe. The most important part about the long-term contracts is the investments, is making sure that, you know, people out there who are looking to invest in a allergy plant or, you know, any number of different, you know, alternative fuels know that there's going to be a market for it. And that's one of the great limitations here is, you know, we've had tax credits that have expired on a yearly basis. Well, how do you make an investment in something if you're counting on that tax credit? Anything you can do to encourage the investment environment. Because the one thing I'm totally optimistic about, you know, based on a lot of the people that I've met with and some of the ideas and technologies that are being developed, we absolutely have the ability to develop technologies that will reduce our dependency on foreign sources of oil, will reduce greenhouse gases, that will reduce our dependency on energy in general. I mean, technologies that improve efficiency, you know, reduce the worst polluting aspects of burning energy, generate alternatives. They're out there. They just need to get to scale, and they need the investment dollars. And the investment dollars will come when investors are confident, relatively, in the future. And somebody tell me one time that, you know, we just want certainty. That doesn't work. It doesn't happen. I mean, if you come across that world, please take me to it, because we don't live in it. So, you know, it's not a matter of giving certainty, but giving at least a little bit more predictability about the marketplace so people feel free to put the money down and really begin to invest, sort of develop those new technologies that are critical to what we're doing. That's why I think long-term contracts are so important and something we need to do.
Well, now that we have, knowing that the price has been continually increasing, what portion of the conversation in DC has been ideological and what has been actually grounded in the real budgetary concerns that we're looking at long term?
Well, too much of it's been ideological. I think the comment from Senator Coates drives home that point. I will say one thing. No society that is at our economic level is ever going to be energy independent. And we all set that as the goal. We don't want to be. I mean, there's always going to be a mix of fuels, but you can reduce your dependency rather dramatically, and that is important. The climate change issue has really turned against us, you know, from public policy. If you think back to the 2008 campaign, it was in John McCain's policy that he supported alternative fuels, believed in climate change, believed that alternative energies was made very important. Sarah Palin signed on to her. She was his vice presidential candidate. And yet, just, you know, a month ago, I was sitting in a room with John McCain listening to him argue against all of the provisions in our defense bill that, you know, were designed to encourage alternative sources of fuel. And basically said, we're trying to think about climate change and all that stuff. Buy the cheapest fuel right now, it's available to you, and that's what we got to do. So we have really lost a ton of ground in the last 5 years, and we got to start turning that around with the body politic, with the electorate, because right now their belief is, you know, I just want energy for as cheap as possible wherever. And that's very short-term thinking, because number one, climate change is real, as has been stated, has very real implications. But second, that short-term thinking stops you from having the alternatives, because the only thing that's going to stop us from having that huge spike every time oil goes up is being in a position to say, you know what, oil's going up, we don't want to buy it, we're going to buy something else. That something else isn't on the table right now. So ideologically, we have lost that battle. Lost, it's a bit too strong of a statement. We are losing. We are not in a great position. We need to recapture the ground to get people to think of the policy in a different way.
So question for Andrew. So you mentioned the ASP's climate security report from November. Now, clearly, and I think everybody in the room has heard multiple times today that there's a nexus between climate change and national security. I was at a conference a year ago, and it was said that, well, you know, the Department of Defense is not worried about climate change because they're worried about bears and bats and bunnies. They're worried because if polar ice caps melt, we need more boats to patrol those waters. Do you see a nexus between DOD's energy use and climate change, or is that just not an important part of the discussion?
You know, it's a good question. I don't know. The DOD should reduce energy uses in order to be able to better fight and win America's wars. That's what we want our Department of Defense to do. That's what we hire our warfighters to do. We don't hire them to go out and deal with a long-term problem. Climate change is a whole-of-government solution. It requires whole-of-government solution. It's too big for the Department of Defense. This is something that, you know, we shouldn't look at. There's a tendency in Washington to think of let's just put it in the Pentagon because that's easier to get through Congress, or something like that. You know, we shouldn't look to our defense establishment to solve all of our problems. This is something that in terms of climate change, we need to do this throughout the whole government and the whole of society. So, you know, the change of energy sources from, oil to alternative fuels, energy efficiency, everything that Sharon talked about, you know, we shouldn't be asking our warfighters to also fight climate change. Now, that said, they should be preparing for climate change. We see the effects of climate change happening every day. You talked about the Arctic, but also talk about increased desertification in sub-Saharan Africa, places like Mali. Talk about water shortages, water security issues in South Asia. Talk about rising sea levels for large delta cities in East Asia. All of these are major security issues, and by the way, it's also homeland security issues as well. So this is about preparing when you talk about the national security establishment. We shouldn't be relying on the Department of Defense to be mitigating climate change. That's something that we should do in a broader perspective.
Steve, the release of that report, you had said, and this was just before, I think you released it the week before the election, you said it's probably not going to matter on Tuesday, but you hope it matters on Wednesday, when you find out who would be in the White House for the next 4 years. Now that that question is kind of answered and we're into the second term for President Obama, what are maybe two takeaways from that report that you're hoping, now that it's Wednesday, will actually take?
Well, you know, again, maybe it was serendipity, but we didn't know who was going to get elected, and we certainly didn't know who was going to be nominated to be SecDef or SecState. But ASP felt, of course, climate change and energy security were two of the biggest issues facing the country that needed to be tackled, that were pretty unpopular, and they did not become big campaign issues. They were stayed away by the president and others for obvious reasons, but the president's been reelected, and he's made it a priority. I think one of the biggest takeaways has got to be that the next administration, this administration, has to make it a priority, and they have to strike early and often. It's not one of these that you can wait, and hopefully in two more years, maybe there'll be a more favorable Congress. I think they got to start working on that issue right now, because it's a security issue that is not just 10, 30, 50 years out. It's one that's impacting us on a daily basis, and we've got to take that on. We've got to take it on early and often. And I think you're going to see that. I mean, you're going to see it from Kerry, you're going to see it from Hagel, you're going to see it from President Obama.
Last question that I want to start putting it out to the audience. So start thinking of your questions now and raise your hands early. This is for General Buchanan. So at bottom, you identify as an infantry officer. And after 4 tours in Iraq, I think you can identify with the comment that was made earlier this morning by Ken Berlin when he talked about the need for demand to drive growth. We need the people that are using what's needed to tell us what to develop. The forward deployed airmen, Marines, and soldiers, what do they need? And from your experience, what can they do on a soldier by soldier basis to drive down their own energy use? How can we help them?
Well, I think this gets at both the issue about facilities. They need to have their basic needs met. Shelter, food, water, ammunition. Somewhere in there in Maslow's hierarchy, I'm sure. But they need that in order to accomplish their mission. And sort of from the top down, they need a mission, they need a task and a purpose, and then the resources to accomplish that. So that's basically what they need. Now, when you talk to Specialist Jones or Senior Airman Smith, and you ask them what they need on the ground, they can give you some pretty good ideas about how to make a specific system better and more efficient. And this is, I think, what Secretary Burke hit the nail on the head with the rapid equipping force. Just one innovation. I'll just make a plug for some of the innovations we've seen over the last 10 years, really through the support of all of you and especially Congress, have been incredible. And our troops have never suffered for lack of want because everybody responded to the call when they identified the need, whether it was better armor for our vehicles. So I think there are mechanisms out there to identify what those needs are, and the American people and the Congress have been very responsive in meeting those needs. It's been very helpful. But at the same time, like I said, from the military perspective, we have to do our part. We have to link up the guys rather than just, you know, the senior airman or the specialist that's on that forward operating base. You know, maybe the people that are working details about aircraft technologies and how do they link in with industry to drive use of different types of fuels or more efficient fuels, et cetera. And at the individual level, how can we conserve? We have a long-term approach that's really a partner with all of you and a partnership with industry about how we can drive technology so that we can reduce dependence, not necessarily eliminate it, but at least reduce dependence on foreign fuel, on fossil fuels. And we're depending on a partnership to work together to make that a reality. Short term, though, we've got to conserve what we do have. We've got to be good stewards of what all of you give us. And so I'll just give you one example. Within Joint Base Lewis-McChord, you know, we can't afford to drive 5 different trucks from different units to go out to the range to qualify on our machine guns, and that be the only event that we are doing. What we've got to do is make the movement to the range a training event. It's a tactical operation, so we get as much out of that. We get as most efficient use out of the ammunition that we're shooting. We make the movement back a tactical event. So every one of those things is a training event, and you don't have a truck driving there with a driver and one person in the passenger seat and nobody in the back. If you make it all an operation, you can actually get a lot more benefit out of it. You know, First Corps right now is designated one of the Army lead efforts to be a regionally aligned force to work with the Pacific Command. And when we were first working last fall with Admiral Locklear, the combatant commander, and his staff, the Army has not been very involved in the Pacific for the last 12 years because we've been very engaged in Central Command in the Middle East. And so when we were talking with the Pacific Command staff, we needed to make sure that they understood what we could offer from Joint Base Lewis-McChord, as also as well as reassure them that, in fact, we could be there. And in fact, when they look on a map, they say, you know, the Pacific Northwest is a long ways away from the Philippines. What are you going to do us? What good are you going to do for us that are here in Hawaii? Well, at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, we have 46,000 troops, and we're co-located with 52 C-17s. You know, we're within 50 miles of four deep water ports. No other large Army base is facing that situation. So we're very relevant to anything that goes on in the Pacific, and we can get there in a hurry. Every one of those movements, though, takes a lot of fuel. And I think it's on all of us to figure out how to do that more efficiently and more effectively.
So I want to open it up to folks for questions. I also want to be aware of time as we're going forward. I know Congressman Smith has a hard stop in a few minutes to get to his next engagement. So I open the floor.
Curious whether or not we see biofuels, particularly biofuels used by the Navy, as reaching anytime soon a tipping point in terms of critical mass of deployment, and what the implications of that will be on commercial and civilian applications for biofuels, and then what are still the innovation puzzles that are unsolved to help to enable that to happen?
Okay. I'll first start off by saying I'm not an engineer, or a chemist, so I'm not. I don't know the exact innovation details that need to be hurdled, and I think they change based on which technology you're talking about, whether you're talking about cellulosic ethanol or cellulosic biomass or algae or any of the other fuels. I would say that the Defense Production Act, there's a joint program between the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and U.S. Department of Agriculture to invest $510 million, matched with private funding over the next 3 years. And it may actually, I'm told it may actually be more. Sharon would know better than I did. but it's a program that will invest in new production capacity for biofuels, and I'm told that the goal is to get it to have it at scale. That matched with the renewable fuel standard, which has a growing portion of the national fuel load devoted to advanced biofuels, will drive this market a lot. So you'll have this scale coming in, and once you have scale, then I think prices will drop fast. Steve mentioned there was a Department of Energy study that said you could see price competitiveness by 2016, 2017, 2018. Now a lot of that depends on where the price of oil goes, and if you know that, then go to Wall Street. I don't. But I suspect that it's going up, and I suspect that the price of biofuels is going down. So at some point, those lines will cross, and then it's about scale.
Thank you. This question is for all panelists, and I hate to be. I hate to be a buzzkill, but there's a couple of things that bother me about this whole discussion. One is I had the opportunity to go to North Dakota last summer, and I was appalled by the conditions there. It was like visiting Kuwait or somewhere right after the invasion. There was unregulated flaring. The whole countryside reeks of petroleum. there was virtually no control over what was going on there. And second, I think what we're seeing is a general backlash against fracking. People are concerned about their drinking water. Some people are concerned about fracking causing earthquakes and so on. And whether or not that's true is irrelevant, because there is a backlash. Some people believe it. And some states are now taking action to either greatly restrict or prohibit fracking. Second, I think there's been a gross overestimation of the potential of non-food crop biofuels. And a court decision that was announced this morning castigated EPA for overestimating fuels from non-food sources. This suit was brought by the American Petroleum Institute. So I think you're going to see opposition from environmental groups and from the petroleum industry on the development of biofuels, particularly non-food biofuels. And I wonder if you could react to that to see, you know, what impact that's going to have on your plans.
If I could, and I have to go as soon as I make these quick comments to the other panelists. Look, this is all very hard. And if we gave the impression that there was some, you know, easy path forward on an energy future that's going to protect us. I mean, when you look at the statistics in terms of the increase in consumption of energy throughout the globe and the sources of it, and then you add in, you know, the environmental implications of some of those sources, this is a very, very difficult policy challenge. I don't think anyone up here would apply it. But if we just take that step, it's all good. There's massive potential for coal, for instance, on the clean burning side of it, except the fact that you still got to get it out of the ground. And that's a nasty, nasty process as well. The one thing I will say, though, in terms of technology and innovation, and particularly on the alternatives, efficiencies, and biofuel side, efficiency number one, we have so much room to reduce our utilization. So much room. It's just incredible what we could do in order to get the same amount of output, forgive me, the terminology here, for the same amount of energy. I mean, it's just a ton of work that can be done on that side. Second of all, I think that innovation leads to greater results. And I think predicting exactly what the future is for biofuels, I think there's a lot of potential there. They haven't gotten there. They are not yet competitive with petroleum, with oil-based fuels. They're not there. And as I mentioned, they got that 150-year infrastructure head start. Part of the reason that the biofuels don't have the capacity that they have is they don't have the refineries, they don't have the pipelines, they don't have the stations, they don't have all the stuff that, if I got out of there and climbed in the car and said, oh, I need gas, in 2 minutes, I'd be at a gas station, even if I was in, someplace I didn't even know. It's all right there, it's all built, and we haven't done that on the biofuel side. And I think all we're arguing, do it, give us that alternative so that we're not dependent upon the fracking, so that we at least put, as cliche has been, you've got to be in favor of an all of the above strategy because of many of the problems that you outlined and many, many others that are there as well. And with that, I have to sprint, and I'll turn it over to my very able panelists to further answer that question.
I'll jump on real quick on the court decision on cellulosic biomass, non-food crop biofuels. You're right. They haven't come in yet. I would say that cellulosic ethanol, which was the subject of the court case, is like ethanol, it's like biofuel 1.5. It's still ethanol, so it's an inferior fuel. You can't run your car on it. You definitely can't fly a plane on it. When you start talking about non-food crop biofuels, there is an important distinction there. And in law, it's not a distinction. But there is a definite difference between cellulosic ethanol, which was the subject of this case, and then a drop-in replacement biofuel. So something like an algae-based biofuel, advanced biofuel. So you call it an advanced hydrocarbon or any number of things like that. So it's that's where the potential is. And frankly, I do think we need to get to a point where we're getting away from food crop biofuels because, you know, about 40% of our corn crop goes through ethanol distilleries. Now, a lot of that is then returned to farmers as distillers' grains, but that's a big portion, and that has impacts on world markets. So for it to be truly sustainable, there is a lot of biomass out there, and the technology is getting there to make it us able to put it into our tank. And frankly, I think that this is important, maybe not for our cars, but especially for which we can, you know, fuel economy standards, we can reduce the amount of fuel we use. And we can drive on batteries. We can do all these sorts of things. But you can't fly on a battery. You can't, you need an energy-dense liquid fuel, and you're going to for the long term. And aviation is going to continue to grow. So you got to have something. And I think biofuels are really the only alternative there.
Introduce yourself.
Andrea McFadden. You may have all mentioned this earlier today, and I missed it. Do we have a renewable fuel portfolio standard for the department that we're shooting for a certain percentage?
The one thing I can say is at least within the Army, we have a number, and this is a little bit of a waffle answer, so I don't know directly, but I can tell you that we do have a number of installations that have been designated as net zero installations, and they have goals or actually mandates that they have to achieve by a certain time frame. 2020 is the baseline, and it depends on the installation. At Joint Base Lewis-McChord, we're supposed to be net zero for both water and wastewater, which means that we don't kick out any wastewater. Fort Carson is one for energy, and they've gone completely to an electric non-tactical vehicle fleet. And some of this is it's a series of pilot programs so that we can figure out what works best and apply it across DOD. So that I know about that, but I don't know about DOD mandates across the department.
From a statutory standpoint, the answer is no.
Yeah.
For operational energy, the Congress has not set a goal for the Department of Defense for its operational energy efficiency. From an installation energy standpoint, they have set goals for the integration of renewable energy over the next 12 years by 2025. But not for operational energy, which would be fuel.
And I would say that a couple of the services do have goals for alternative fuel use. The Air Force says that by 2016 they have a goal to be able to fuel 50% of the force with alternative fuel. So that's
domestic.
Yeah, that domestic fuel. And then the Navy says by 2020 plan to be 50% fueled by alternative fuels.
Right. Those are non-statutory goals.
Correct.
Those are goals that are set by the Department of Defense. Other questions? One more?
Hi, Stephen Johnson with the Illinois Clean Fuels here again. As a producer of advanced biofuels, I'd like to kind of contribute to the narrative here. This is commonly attacked as if it's a technology problem. And I would advance the discussion that perhaps in point of fact, it's actually not primarily a technology issue. We have, in point of fact, had the ability to manufacture synthetic gasoline, diesel fuel, and jet fuel dating all the way back to World War II.
Yes.
If you take a basic process technology just like that of Gasworks Park up on the north end of town here, combine it with a process the Germans used to run their jet planes during World War II, you can produce biofuel today. The challenge is one of achieving economic scale. I know these numbers quite well. In fact, the Air Force and NETL and others have done quite a few studies on this. And the challenge is to build conversion infrastructure that actually achieves a competitive toe-to-toe unit cost. You have to build it very large. You're talking on the 30,000 barrel a day, multi-billion dollar capital investment type category. And that creates another problem, which is that the ability to source biomass at the scale required to feed a facility like that doesn't exist. There simply is no supply chain to do it. So this is definitely a bit of a systems integration issue, I think perhaps more than a technology problem. Also one thing that I think would be very useful to loop into the discussion is the folks from the project finance community. Having been on the phone with two of the top project finance investment banks inside the space of the last week, I think helping set some of the programs up from the demand side, where we've seen tremendous leadership from the Air Force and other aspects of the military, and matching what they can do as a consumer of first resort with the needs of the investment banking community that are driving the pension funds of everyone in this room to make sure that the projects that are invested in do in fact perform well. I think that's going to be part of the key to integrating these systems together in a way where we make a meaningful scaled impact on the problem.
Reactions to that? I agree, it's a capacity issue and it's not a technology issue.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back a little bit to Secretary Gates' comment about investment in R&D, and that, you know, we keep cutting back, and do that in conjunction with the corporate community, and we can do all kinds of things. So I just agree with everything you said, Andrew.
Yeah, I agree completely. Definitely, everything everybody I've talked to has said the same sort of thing. This is not a technology issue. This is a cost issue and a scale issue. So it's economics. And competing with, as Congressman Smith says, there's 150 years of infrastructure and investment in this, and basically as a monopoly. So with excess profits that they can push right back into it. So it's tough to compete against that. Maybe it would be easier if banks were lending better, and maybe it would be easier if, you know, we could get long-term contracts, and it would be easier if there was a ready-made feedstocks. It takes a while, and it's difficult. And I commend you for getting into the industry, and I think that's great. I think it's an incredibly important industry, so thank you.
All right, with that, I think we'll wrap it up. Thank you, General Buchanan, Mr. Holland, and Mr. Chief, and Representative Smith, who's going to leave early. Appreciate you being here.